And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of August 25th, 2019. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah Tinker?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. So there are a lot of numbers that float around the climate world. Some of them are more difficult to understand than others. But one of the big numbers that is around is the concept that there basically it's a number of 2 degrees. You'll hear it all the time. Sometimes you hear 1.5 degrees, but you hear 2 degrees as the target, right? And basically what the argument is that we as a human species should not allow the planet to increase in temperature by 2 degrees above the temperature as it was in 1776, right? That we got to keep it less. The global average, right? And the global average means take all the temperatures everywhere around the globe for a whole year, put them all in a blender, figure out what's that average temperature. That average temperature should not go up by more than 2 degrees because of various horrific consequences. That's a
Celsius.
Did I say it? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you said
it. I mean, so there's this concept that we can't have a 2 degree rise in temperature, but that can be abstract. So this past week, our friends at the Washington Post, Mariah, I'll let you maybe explain some of what's in there. Our friends at the Washington Post did an interesting study of the continental United States and what the temperature rises have been, right?
Yeah, right. So they dove into more than a century of temperature data and found that there's some areas that are heating more quickly than others. And it was kind of fascinating. I mean, there's actually several places that are already at 2 degrees Celsius above, you know, the historical averages. And then there's some places that there's in these sort of like cooling pockets where they're not actually warming at all.
Really?
And yeah, I mean, the major takeaways I think that came from the article is that the warming across, you know, the warming across the world and the nation is very uneven. So some regions are going to be more than 2 and some are going to be barely be warmed at all.
Mm-hmm.
Since they've been taking records, I think from 1895 to 2018, I'm sure they've been taking records longer than that, but this is the period.
Right. The temperature, the thermometer temperatures, right? From the 1880s
right,
or so.
Comparing with. Right. And then that because there's several regions that show these really clear, strong warming signals.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of, that's the hallmark as, yep, this is climate change, it's happening now.
Right.
It's human caused. And the Northeast has been particular. It's definitely one of the warmer areas. And we can talk more about the specifics of which areas of the Northeast and what we're seeing. But the overarching message from this Washington Post article was that the Northeast, the winter season has been transformed. It's not the same winter that we are used to.
Right.
I can attest to as a cross-country skier that it certainly seems different, even in just my small time of interacting with it. But that's empirical evidence, not actual data. But anyways, and then the other points they had is that there's a disparity of how many people are living in each of the areas that are fast warming, and some of them don't have very many people and some are highly populated. So there's no relationship really there.
Forgive me for interrupting, but I mean, that's an interesting point, because the first argument people have is that something called the urban heat island.
Exactly.
That is that there is, you know, if you put a lot of concrete and bricks and then shine the sun on it, that's going to warm up, and so the average temperature of those urban areas will be higher, and you need to account for that. But this article is making the point that there are some places that have no urban structure and they're showing hot spots as well for various reasons.
Yeah,
right?
And even that the amount of heat coming from the urban heat effect, they're saying it's not enough to account for the drastic temperatures, the amount of warming that's happening. So, you know, this is above and beyond what they'd get from urban heat warming. And then the final point they made in this article was that the changes are already having major impacts, which are sort of vary depending on where you are. So, right, mm-hmm. the northeastern region, we're feeling the changes in agriculture and greater pressure from insects such as ticks and mosquitoes and agricultural pests.
My memory is that there were two particular places that they used to exemplify the kind of changes. One was a lake in New Jersey someplace, and
yeah, like
the second
Hopatcong
Lake in New Jersey, and then there was a seaside resort town in Rhode Island. And the dramatic changes that are documented in people's lives, right? I mean, you said it's kind of subjective to talk about cross-country skiing, but certainly one of the interesting things is that for decades and decades, people would bet money on the day the ice broke up on various lakes in New Hampshire and Maine and New Jersey, right? That was a game, right, to guess what day the ice. So it's very carefully documented, and they see that those ice out dates have been progressing to be earlier and earlier in the spring. I think that the article talked a lot about how in the 1910s, this Lake Hopatcong, or whatever it is, the lake in New Jersey, was a big source of ice, which at the time, since there was no refrigeration, was packed up and shipped off to New York City, and how it doesn't freeze anymore there. And I mean, to switch back to the Massachusetts, I mean, I grew up near Rhode Island, and I know that when I was younger, you could go skating outdoors through much of the winter. And nowadays it just does not freeze. Right? You just don't get, you don't get ice skating days. Right? And when you do, you're terrified that some kids are going to fall through the ice because it's only half an inch thick. Right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's shocking. Just, you know, take a minute and think about that it's at the point, the climate has changed enough that we can remember it in our lifetimes. Right. So it can't be gradual if it's something that's so, I mean, it's gradual in some ways, but the fact that you can remember, you can note the difference in the ice skating season.
Yeah,
you know, this Lake Hopatcong, it says that it used to freeze over by Thanksgiving, and now it rarely freezes until January.
Right.
And that's a, you know, that's a big shift.
And I think that one of the, you know, you say, well, 30 years ago, blah, 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 but it's important as climate people to recognize that we're talking about geological scale, that geologically these things happen over thousands of years, right? So it takes hundreds to thousands of years for these things to happen naturally. And of course, we see it in the course of 30 years, and you say, okay, that's way too fast, right? That's not a geological change.
And then there's economic fallout from that too, right? So, you know, some of the arguments that always drive me crazy about climate change is trying to address it is going to be so expensive, and it's going to cost us so much money, and it's going to tank the economy, which is not true. There's plenty of studies to show that it's not. But then you think about all of the things, the expense that it costs not to address climate change. And this Lake Hopatcong is sort of a microcosm of that, because the winter, the stuff, they had all kinds of sort of tourists activities that would happen around this big frozen lake and different events. I think there was something about ice sailing. They would have boats that sail across the ice, you know.
I knew a guy who had an ice sailing boat on Long Island.
Oh,
okay?
Wow.
And
I would love to see that.
Yeah, it doesn't freeze anymore. Right?
Yep. And so that's, you know, they've lost that. And then I guess also when they've taken a hit, because in the summer, it's usually really a busy summer destination, but it had to be shut down because of toxic bacteria. So all of these places that are usually restaurants and businesses and the stores that are usually packed with people lost all of that business, because the beach that everybody goes to, this Lake Hopatcong beach, was closed. And
I mean, I think, you know, what I found interesting in the article was that it was a very granular, realistic look at the consequences of climate change, right, is that it takes something as big as climate change and it brings it down to the idea that this little restaurant on the lake of Lake, on the shores of Lake Hopatcong, right, didn't have any business on the 4th of July weekend because a new blue-green algae had invaded the lake and the whole lake smelled, right? Nobody wanted to be there, right?
Yeah, so no, it's dangerous. You can't swim in it.
So this very concrete example of what happened. I think that's what makes the article interesting, is there's lots of very specific consequences that have come from this tiny taste of global warming. I mean, I think it's important to note that, I mean, the fact that it's 2 degrees warmer on average at Lake Hopatcong is bad for the immediate effects in Lake, the lake, right? But I mean, it doesn't, you know, if the whole world was 2 degrees warmer, you would have to multiply that badness by the disease and famine and all the other stuff that would be happening in other places, right? That this story is just about what 2 degrees does to this lake.
Yeah, it puts it sort of makes something, right? The problem with climate change is it's so far outside of our everyday worldview. We can't conceptualize of a planet that's 2 degrees warmer on average. What does that even mean? What does that look like? Right. And that makes it really hard to sort of connect with it and care about it.
Because 2 degrees seems like nothing, right?
Right, yeah. But this really puts a finer point on that, where it makes you start visualizing what that world looks like, and it's not the world that you want it to be, right? I mean, so it really makes you kind of, it's sort of, I think that's the
power
of the article in that
it's
way.
It's an interesting, I think somewhere in the article they make the point that the freezing temperature, that things don't freeze as much as they used to, right? And that the real, from a climate change perspective and for the damage of climate change, how often stuff freezes is an important marker, because freezing in the winter kills the bugs. It kills a lot of stuff, right? If you don't freeze, then all that stuff survived to come back out in the springtime and be, you know, nasty earlier in the year, right? You want is a good, hard freeze to kill things. And even at the level of a few degrees, you know, if you're on average 2 degrees warmer, I mean, all those days when you were, used to be 31 degrees, you're now 33 degrees, you didn't freeze, right? And it's, there are consequences of that.
Right, yeah, and I mean, even, absolutely, that the bugs, I think, are, of course, a problem, that they don't freeze, they don't die off, they have longer seasons, you have double, triple the bug populations, and of course, a lot of those are disease vectors.
Right.
So you end up having more vectors that might be carrying Lyme disease or might be carrying triple E. And then the other thing that, I mean, winter freezes are really important. Part of the reason the aquatic weeds that have caused the beach to be shut down at Lake Hopatcong is because there was fertilizer runoff that was combined with warm winters. That freeze also helps stop the weeds from growing. It kills off, you know, sort of the dangerous plants that can shut down a whole lake and cause an algal bloom and so on and so forth. So these areas that are used to these winters are very dependent on them for the natural cycles to continue to happen.
And I guess one of the things that I would point out, that, you know, we're based in Massachusetts, New England. I mean, I don't like to think of us being as New England centric podcast, because we touch on a lot of stuff. But it turns out that the map of the New England area showing the temperature differences, the hot spots of more than 2 degrees, all of eastern Massachusetts and most of Rhode Island is already above 2 degrees warming, right?
Yeah.
And in most of Rhode Island is more than that. So you look at this and you say, man, this is hitting home. This is right on top of where I live. And it's very instructive. I think if you haven't seen the article, go check we'll put a link on the blog, but you can see the big red spot south of Boston and a big red spot over most of Rhode Island showing more than 2.5 degree warming. I mean, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, I know. It makes you think, if I had to live anywhere in a planning my climate change, my home in a climate change way, you kind of say, well, this is going to be hot up here.
Well, you know, I mean, you can start thinking about where you want to live when the climate changes, but you probably find out that there's a bunch of guys with camo suits and AK-47s already there to prevent you from moving in, right? That's not a good... Anyway, so I would recommend, if you get a chance, read this article. It's an interesting, very clear statement about what kinds of things climate change may do to us. The other thing that I wanted to touch base on, Mariah, is something that I picked up recently, came out today, and I'll just kind of report it so that people can search out and read about it if they want. Our so-called president seems to have this fixation of destroying everything that President Obama did. One of the important things that President Obama did in 2012 was to forge an agreement among all the major car companies for rather aggressive mileage standards for new automobiles, so that by the year 2024 or 25, I think, the average efficiency of the fleet had to be 50 miles per gallon, the average. I mean, that's really quite aggressive. And Obama got that in 2012, mostly, I think, for the price of saving the automobile companies, right, with big loans after the Great Recession. Anyway, long and short.
And that's often referred to as the CAFE standards, right?
The CAFE standards, yes. Yeah, combined average fleet efficiency.
Right.
Anyway, good on Obama for getting that through. And, of course, the current occupant of the White House can't stand that. Just gets under his skin that somebody else did something good. So he's been trying to reverse those CAFE standards and get rid of them. And basically had his toadies at the EPA and whatnot put out regulations that would eliminate the stringent requirements that Obama had negotiated. The unfortunate for the White House, the unfortunate thing is that California and 18 other states who stand in union with California gets to set its own standards. I just remind you that when the Clean Air Act was passed in the 1970s, California was so far ahead, had so much more pollution, that Congress gave California the right to set more stringent limitations on air pollution because Los Angeles was just so horrible that California could do more than the federal government. So California has this right to be more aggressive, and California has exercised that right over the years, and any other states like Massachusetts that want to join California can't. So there you go. So all of a sudden, Trump wants to roll back the Obama CAFE standards. California says, nay, 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 we like them. And there's a face-off, right? So what has happened in the last few days is that several of the big car companies, not all of them, but several, enough of the big car companies have gone to California and said, they want to stay with the California standards, the more aggressive standards for the CAFE, the fuel efficiency limits. And why do they want to do that? Because the automobile companies know that if Trump pushes through his regulations, California will sue. And over the next 10 or 15 years, there'll be a long, drawn-out court battle over the automobile efficiencies. And the automobile makers are going to have to make two different kinds of cars. They're going to have to try and make everybody happy. They're going to be caught in the crossfire of political infighting, and they don't want that. So the car companies are saying, hey, the rest of the world is going to more efficient automobiles, probably electric cars. That's what they're doing in China and Europe and everywhere else. Car companies want to play in that market. They don't want to have two different kinds of markets. The car companies want to work with California. That leaves Trump and his White House down in the dumps. So I think the good news is that, at least as of right now, the tide is turning against Trump's attempt to roll back the Obama-era good fuel efficiency standards. I mean, that's a hopeful thing. That's all I can give you. It's a little bit
that's
hopeful.
Great news.
It's good news. We'll put up a link to it. Of course, it hasn't actually happened yet. But I mean, once these big car companies get involved, it changes the picture. So there's that. The other thing that I want to remind everyone is that September 20th is rapidly approaching. September 20th is the week, September 20th to the 27th, but primarily on September 20th will be the climate strike, student strike for climate, which we're hoping that many people will leave their job, will take a day of vacation, walk out of their jobs, but at the very least, support the climate strike, which will happen on September 20th. There's going to be one in Boston. Please start thinking about how you can participate in that event on the 20th, because it's very important. We'll put up the link to Bill McKibben's article calling for all the grown-ups to help the kids do the right thing. There you go, Mariah. Anything else?
I'll be there.
We'll put up links. We'll put up all those links on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find this show on the Facebook page at /massclimateaction. You can send to us something called an email. It's this electronic communication system in which you type stuff in and we can read it. All right, so you can tell us, if you send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net, what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show, what you think we ought to be talking about. You can listen to the show, of course, directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, most of the modern distribution apps, and, of course, Apple Podcast. I want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. And we want to close by the way we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty is to speak out. So we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.